From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Whether you're hearing this in a turkey coma or a post-gathering house-cleaning frenzy, we are very grateful to have you tuning in and very grateful to have your ongoing support for this program. And if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
America must use the Holy Bible as a guide to return to her Lord God.
I do believe the election of Donald Trump is directly related to the prophecies of the Bible.
You've got two Muslim women, Rashida Tlaib in Michigan, Ilhan Omar in Minnesota.
You cannot have somebody who is adherent to Sharia serving in public office. The founders, by the way, were very clear that only Christians should hold public office.
The only thing worse than fighting the same battles over and over again is not having anybody to fight them. And so as the political religious right continues to insist that only the religious convictions of some deserve protection and that no limits should exist to circumscribe the oppression of all other belief systems that inevitably result, the battle goes on and on with Interfaith Alliance at the forefront. On this week's show, we'll review the progress made and the new challenges taken up with Alliance President Jack Moline. But first,
Heather lives in a little house with a big apple tree in the front yard and lots of tall grass in the backyard.
Heather's favorite number is two. She has two arms, two legs, two eyes, two ears, two hands, and two feet.
She also has two pets, a ginger-colored cat named Ginger Snap, and a big black dog named Midnight.
Heather also has two mommies, Mama Jane and Mama Kate.
Mama Jane and Mama Kate.
When the innocuous-looking children's book, Heather Has Two Mommies, appeared way back in 1989, author Leslia Newman could not have possibly known how this title would continue to resonate through the decades. And yes, it was the first book about lesbian parents aimed at kids, but not only did it help give birth to a literary genre, it became the single most mentioned book title on the lips of the political religious right. You know, the crowd that disingenuously tries to claim the mantle of family values. We'll never know how many book sales were inadvertently inspired by that opposition, just like we'll never know how many same-sex families were inspired, affirmed, and encouraged by the book and the ones that followed. We do know that the author has made an immeasurable contribution to our culture and to our society, and so I am overjoyed to welcome Leslia Newman to State of Belief Radio and our special series, Whosoever You Love. Leslia, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
When did you first realize that you wanted to be a writer?
So I started writing poems when I was very young, probably about 10 years old. My family moved from Brooklyn, New York to Long Island. So I went from an urban environment to a suburban environment, and I was very lonely and unhappy about that change. And so nobody said to me, why don't you write some poems? You'll find that comforting. But somehow innately, I decided to do that. And so I've been doing that ever since. This is 17 Magazine from 1976, and this was my very first publication. I had three poems in here.
My goodness. Were LGBTQ topics part of your work from the very beginning?
No. I didn't come out till I was 27. So I wrote a lot about animals. That was really my main theme for a very long time, I have to say.
Were you wanting to write about LGBTQ, or just you weren't there yet?
I was completely unaware of my own identity and even in the possibility of that identity at that point in my life.
I see. So when did you first realize there was a need for a book like Heather Has Two Mommies?
This is the first version of the book that came out in December 1989, as you said. Uh-huh. And then this is the new edition that came out in 2015, I believe. So basically, it was all a fluke. I had published a novel for adults and a book of poetry for adults when a woman in Northampton, Mass. Stopped me on the street and said somebody should write a book that features a lesbian couple and their child so I can have a book to read to my daughter that shows a family like ours. So I took that request very seriously because as a Jewish child, growing up in the 1950s, I never was read a book that showed a family like mine. Mm-hmm. And so I knew the loneliness of that. And I also knew, conversely, how validating it can be to see oneself in a work of literature. And in the children's book community now, there is this whole concept about windows and mirrors. So mirrors are important so you can validate your own experience. And windows are important so you could look out into the world and see somebody else's experience. And so that teaches empathy. And so that is how I started in the wonderful world of children's books.
What was the process for writing that first book? Was it difficult to write, and was it difficult to get published?
Well, I was very naive. I had this misconception that many people have, which is children's books. There's not that many words. How hard can it be? Well, it's kind of like poetry. It's very, very difficult. And so I didn't really have any training in this form. So I went to the library and I just came home with armloads of picture books and just read them and studied them and then came up with Heather Has Two Mommies. And then I tried to get it published in traditional avenues. So I sent it out to all the lesbian publishers that existed at the time. And they said, we don't do children's books. You should try children's book publishers. So I sent it out to children's book publishers. And they said, we're not doing anything to do with lesbian families. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of stuck. And then I thought about my grandmother, who always said, just because they say no to us, you think we're finished. And so I decided that I would try another way. And one day I was getting together with a friend who named Sivia Gober, who happened to be a lesbian mom with a one-year-old. And she said, let's do it. Or maybe I said, let's do it. One of us said it. You know, we don't remember the exact conversation because who knew, you know, what the result would be. Sure. So we found an illustrator and we did a Kickstarter program long before Kickstarter. We licked envelopes, we stuffed envelopes, we stamped envelopes, and we asked people for a $10 donation. And anyone who sent us $10 would get a book within a year or we would send their money back. And we raised $4,000 that way, and then we printed the book in December of 1989.
What was the initial response? That, of course, that was not the age of social media, so how did you find out the response on that?
Letters from people. You know, at that point, really, it was such a grassroots effort that the word basically spread through the lesbian community. And so I would get letters. I got a letter from a little girl named Tasha who said, thank you for writing Heather Has Two Mommies. I know that you wrote it just for me. Oh. Or I would bump into people. I bumped into a lesbian mom with her son, and she told me that he crossed out the word Heather all throughout the book and put Nick instead. So he wanted to really put himself in that book. And so then the book was in a few, at that point there were a lot more lesbian feminist bookstores than there are now. And so a man named Sasha Allison saw the book in New Words, which was a feminist bookstore in Cambridge at the time. And he was publishing Daddy's Roommate. So he contacted us and said that we should join forces. And my friend and I said, we would love for you to take this over because we're not really publishers. We're both writers. And so that's what happened. And then, you know, once there was a larger publisher involved, then things started escalating.
When you look at that book today, what's your relationship to it and the story and the characters that have become so iconic for people?
Well, I have a complicated relationship with Heather and her moms. It's the book that put me on the map, so to speak. Uh-huh. But I don't think, frankly, that it's my strongest work because I wrote it very early in my career. Mm-hmm. And it's the book that a lot of people think that's the only book I've ever written, which, you know, is annoying. So it's a little complicated. But I'm very glad that lesbian moms have a book that they can read to their kids. I mean, now there are more books, but that definitely was the first. And I'm sorry that Heather had such a hard time in the world with the radical right, but also it was a mixed blessing because it helped get the word out. So you know, everything is a mixed blessing with Heather.
Well, if there's anybody listening to this show that thinks that's the only book you have ever written, let's correct that right now. Talk about some of the other books that you've written for a young audience and what they've meant to your readers.
Well, this is a book called Donovan's Big Day, which is about a little boy whose two moms get married. So it takes place on the day that they wed. And then, ironically, you know, it was so hard for me to get Heather published. And then 20 years later, from doing the math correctly, in 2009, these two books came out, Mommy, Mama, and Me, and Daddy, Papa, and Me, which are for much younger children. These are board books that are just about a child with two moms and a child with two dads that just spend a day together. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about these books to me is that I was approached by a publisher and asked to write these books. So 20 years before, in 1989, I was approaching publishers and asking them to publish Heather, and they said, no, we're not interested, and then they came to me. So there's that. And then two of my newest picture books, this is called Sparkle Boy, uh-huh. And this is a book about a little boy who likes to wear sparkly things, just like his big sister. And then I can't help but show off Gittle's Journey and Ellis Island Story, which is coming out in February, and I'm very, very excited about it. This is an immigration story based on family history.
Good for you. From among all of those children's books, what's your favorite?
My favorite book is always the book I haven't written yet.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about that before we get off. Leslea, you've also written a lot of books for adults. What themes have you focused on there?
So this is a book called A Letter to Harvey Milk, and it's a collection of short stories, and each story focuses on a different Jewish lesbian. Mm-hmm. So I write a lot about lesbian identity and Jewish identity and the intersection and collision between the two.
I see. When you look at the adult books, just reading the responses that you've gotten from them, which of those books do you think people have found most interesting to them and most helpful to them?
Well, I would say two books, and one I actually forgot to bring out of my study, but it's called I Carry My Mother, and it's a book of poetry about my mother's illness and death and my own grief. So it's my favorite thing to write, really, is a long series of poems that has a narrative arc and tells a story. And so that book, I've heard from many, many women that it really helped them with their grieving process. Mm-hmm. A Letter to Harvey Milk is told in the voice of a 77-year-old. The title story is told in the voice of a 77-year-old Holocaust survivor who has a friendship with Harvey Milk. Mm-hmm. And that book, that story has had a life of its own. So it was made into a short film. It was made into a one-person show. It was the only short story in a collection, an anthology of lesbian short stories. It was the only short story with lesbian content in a Jewish anthology, and the only short story with Jewish content in a lesbian anthology. Oh. That's what I meant to say.
Yes.
And it just became a musical, which was about 12 years in the works, that had an off-Broadway run for about 16 weeks. That run just ended in June.
Mm.
So that story has had a lot of lasting effects.
Yeah. Leslie, your life came to be intertwined with the family and friends of Matthew Shepard in an almost eerie way back in 1998. I've been fortunate to work with and become close with Matthew's mother, the incredible Judy Shepard. We worked on hate crimes legislation together. And I know how much she has treasured your contributions to the work that she has devoted herself to. Would you talk about those connections and why that has turned out to be so important?
Yes. So in 1998, I was the keynote speaker for Gay Awareness Week at the University of Wyoming. And so that was arranged the previous spring. And then the day before, or maybe 2 or 3 days before, I was to fly to Wyoming from Massachusetts. I got a phone call from Jim Osborne, who told me that his friend Matt had been attacked and was in the hospital and may or may not live, and things were really kind of wild out there. And he said, I would understand if you didn't want to come. So I said, well, are you canceling Gay Awareness Week? And he said, no. And I said, well, then I will come. And so I arrived on October 12th, the day Matt died, and Jim gave me this armband. So this was the students from the University of Wyoming made about 3,000 of these, and the green circles are an international peace symbol. So I still have that. And I was there to talk about Heather Has Two Mommies, which I did. And then on the plane ride home, I wrote an essay called Imagine. And that was published in about 20 different newspapers across the country at the time. And I promised Matt's friends, whom I met, that I would start all my talks about LGBTQ rights from that point on with talking about Matt and reading that essay. So then the years passed, and I realized as I kept talking about Matt, there were many, many people who had no idea who he was. And that made me very unhappy. And so I wrote this book, October Morning, A Song for Matthew Shepard. And this book explores the impact of Matt's murder on the world through 68 poems that speak in a variety of voices, starting with The Fence, because I felt like I had a question, a burning question, which is what happened at The Fence. And they have kind of reconstructed the timeline and figured out that Matt and his two killers were there for about 15 minutes before the killers took off, you know, leaving Matt, of course, tied to the fence and unconscious. So I had, you know, my aha moment that we poets long for, which is because I kept thinking, if only there were witnesses there. You know, Matt, of course, cannot tell us what happened. The perpetrators, I'm really not interested in talking to or hearing, you know, what they would recount, because I feel like anyone who is capable of such cruelty is capable of telling falsehoods. So then the aha moment was the fence was there. The fence saw everything. The fence was an unwilling participant and might have something to say. This is kind of how poets' minds work. And so I started writing in the voice of the fence, in the voice of the stars, in the voice of the moon, in the voice of animals, and reconstructing that night and the trials and just going on from there. So that is then the book was published by Candlewick Press, and it's been used in schools and classrooms and churches and all over the place, and won a lot of awards. And I'm just very, very grateful for all of that. And it also brought me closer to the Shepherd family, because, of course, I was not going to publish this book unless I told them what I was doing and got their blessing.
Well, there was a very moving ceremony at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. just a few weeks ago, commemorating Matthew Shepard's life and interring his ashes there. As I understand it, you had a hand in some of the music. I'd like for you to just talk about that for a second.
So a man named Craig Hella Johnson, who is a Grammy award-winning composer, wanted to respond musically to this hate crime, and he couldn't figure out quite how to do that. And then he read my book, and he put there's five poems about the fence, speaking from the fence's point of view. So he put those to music as a suite, and that was the beginning of this oratorio that he created, which is a 90-minute choral work called "Considering Matthew Shepard." And so the chorus, Consperari, who's Craig's chorus, sung some of the songs, not the songs based on my work, but other songs during the ceremony, which was quite beautiful.
Yeah. We need to take another break, but I've got a few more questions for author and activist Leslea Newman still to come. And later, a Thanksgiving conversation with Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this weekend, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. So, yeah, I think so many people see activism in terms of protesting and organizing and giving speeches and lobbying legislators. And I know that is critically important, but I think we often undervalue the role creative arts and fiction can play in changing the world. You are as qualified as anybody who has ever been on this show to comment on that. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on what I said.
Well, I certainly believe that art, and especially in my case, literature, can change people's lives. When I was growing up, I read The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank, and that certainly changed my life. It made me really think about what it meant to be a Jew. It made me think and long for more information about my own family history. My grandparents all came from Europe. So I had that firsthand experience. I've also had the experience of, for example, reading from October Morning at a college classroom and having someone stand up and say, "I'm not going to use the word fag anymore. I'm very sorry that I've done so." So I think, again, you know, empathy is really the root of change, in my opinion. And mm-hmm. art can help people feel empathy and think about what it would be like to walk in somebody else's shoes. And, you know, as I say that, I have to pause because one thing that happened to Matt was that after he was beaten and tied to the fence, his shoes were stolen. And I have a poem in the book from the point of view of his shoes. But it's just really important to look through the window at somebody else's life. And I think art can really help us do that because mm-hmm. it touches our heart in a different way than, you know, kind of the blaring of the newspaper and the internet and all those facts. It's so easy to turn that off. But if you're sitting at a performance and you're enraptured or reading a book or looking at a painting, something happens inside you that I think can really inspire you to take action in whatever way makes sense for you. In the Jewish tradition, we have a concept called Tikkun Olam, which translates to repairing the world. And every Jew is assigned this task at birth. And it's understood that it's not your responsibility to do this single-handedly, and that the work may not be finished in your lifetime, but you are still responsible. And every person, because I'm going to extend that invitation not only to people who are of the Jewish religion and faith, has to figure that out for themselves. You know, what can you do to make the world a better place? Which is certainly something we all need to think about in this day and age. So by creating literature, I am hoping that I'm taking part in that.
I'm really glad you went there, because the next thing I wanted to ask you about was what has been the role of your Jewish background in influencing your worldview and the mandate for world changing that clearly drives so much of what you do?
Well, I'm very strongly identified as a Jew, and I grew up with those values. So some of the values I grew up with were community is very, very important. And I grew up surrounded by very strong Jewish women. So I was never taught that women had an inferior role or that I couldn't do anything that I wanted to do. And also my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who came from Russia, basically with really nothing, with literally with a pair of candlesticks, worked all her life for volunteering for charities, because she always felt that there was somebody, no matter how little she had, there was somebody who had less than she did. Mm-hmm. And so I observed that my whole childhood and learned from that, that it's really important to work for other people. And, you know, if you have three pennies, you can keep two and give one away to someone who has none, that kind of thing.
I'm curious as to, across your life, what has been the biggest obstacle that you've had to overcome to do the work that you do and to be the person you are?
Well, people have a hard time believing this because I've written so many books, but for me, the biggest obstacle is what I call page fright. So I sit down, I look at a piece of paper, I still write longhand in a notebook, and it's really terrifying. If I'm working on something, then I go back and I call it pestering. I pester it. You know, I rewrite it, I edit it until it feels right to me. But if I'm back to square one, which is what happens after every poem or story or novel or picture book is written, then there's nothing. It's like looking in a mirror. And I find that terrifying. And so far, I'm going to knock wood. I have managed to come up with a new idea, but the fear is very real that I may be done.
Yeah.
But then if that's the case, there are other things to do.
This is a question that Judy Shepherd and I have talked about a good bit. What are your thoughts about religion generally being used so relentlessly to hurt and ostracize and condemn LGBTQ people?
Well, I think, of course, it's very unfortunate. I think it's a misreading of sacred texts. I'm always puzzled, for example, how people seem to pick and choose. So, for example, you know, they all go to Leviticus and talk about the abomination. And in the Bible, the same Hebrew word, I'm sorry, I don't know the word, that it's translated as abomination, is used to describe people who eat shellfish. So I don't feel like you can have it both ways. Either the abomination is across the board or it's not. So I don't see anybody, you know, really going after people who eat shellfish, for example. Yeah. So I'm a very all or nothing person. But I think really the bottom line of every religion is love thy neighbor. So I would like to see us get back to that.
How would you reassure people who are not feeling very hopeful at this point, especially young people who have known only progress in terms of individual dignity and respect?
You know, it's very, very tough. I just saw a play in New York City yesterday called Gloria, A Life, which was based on Gloria Steinem's life. And Gloria defines herself as a hopeaholic, which is a term I guess she coined. I'd never heard it. I had never heard that she defined herself that way. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, Harvey Milk said, you got to give them hope. And Frank said, I still believe deep down that people inside are basically good. So I go to my heroes when I'm feeling down. And I think if they can still find hope in the world, then I can still find hope.
What have you learned over the years about the importance, for those who are members of marginalized communities of being affirmed and seen and celebrated?
I just think that we, you know, people always talk about, oh, you're preaching to the choir. And I'm like, well, the choir needs support. The choir needs love and acceptance and hugs and positive messages. So I think it's really important to find people who love you and care about you and support you so that you can go out and do the work that you do, knowing that sometimes you might not be welcomed as warmly as you would have hoped.
Yeah.
70 books. That is almost incomprehensible. What's the one, this goes back to where we were a while ago. What's the book you want to write, but haven't found the time or the right moment? Do you have a dream project that you're looking forward to the most?
You know, I don't really work that way. The way I work is, as a writer, I forget his name now, so famously said, I sit down and open a vein and see what pours out. But what I'm working on right now is, my dad died about a year ago. And, you know, I mentioned that book of poetry I carry, my mother, about my mom. And so, of course, I always knew I would write a book about my dad as well. So that is what I'm working on right now.
Giving new meaning to the word prolific, Leslea Newman is the author or editor of some 70 books so far, more coming, including the seminal children's book Heather Has Two Mommies and many, many other invaluable titles for the youngest readers. Her body of work includes also a great number of books for adults as well, addressing a wide range of topics and garnering enough awards to fill a single spaced page. Leslea, I don't know if there will ever be a way to measure the impact that you've had on LGBTQ families and on the rest of us with your decades of work, but I do know there are few who have had that level of impact, who have given so many children the simple gift of seeing their lives represented in accessible, affirming book form, as well as to their parents and classmates and teachers and neighbors and friends and to the rest of us. Thank you so much for what you do. And thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. You are wonderfully kind, and I appreciate it.
As we pause to observe Thanksgiving Day weekend in many homes known as Enough with the Leftovers Already weekend, we have to take a good, hard look at the organization that sponsors this radio program and podcast that allows us to bring you these comments and conversations week after week, Interfaith Alliance. There is so much work to do at the intersection of religion, government, and politics, but stepping away from that work to spend a few minutes with us is Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline, and for that, I am thankful. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
As always, Welton, I am delighted to be here.
This year is far from over, but I'd like you to look back across the remarkable long stretch of time that has come to be known as 2018, and highlight some of the achievements that you're most proud of.
As always, Welton, I am most proud when Interfaith Alliance is able to bring to bear the 75 faith communities that are represented among our membership and supporters in alliance with the one or two that find themselves the victims of discrimination in this country. And we have done that in so many different ways because there have just been so many different needs this past year. It may seem like it was forever ago, but it wasn't so long ago that we stood with Muslims on the steps of the Supreme Court, concerned about the travel bans that the administration was trying to impose. Much more recently, we stood with the Jewish community of Pittsburgh and the Jewish community across the United States because of the tragedy that occurred there. Though it doesn't strictly fit in our lane of religious freedom, we cannot help but stand with members of the African American community who have suffered, I think, more than any group in this country from systemic racism and discrimination. So those are my proudest moments, when we can bring to bear the unity of faith values with the individual needs of those represented among our membership. Now, I'll add to that that I'm also very pleased and proud that Interfaith Alliance is often called upon to represent that interfaith community at larger events. Not 2 weeks ago, I was in the National Cathedral for the Templeton Prize award to the King of Jordan, which was a remarkable evening. The King spoke lovingly about the real meaning of jihad and how it is the struggle for perfection within, and how not just the Muslim community, but all communities have to stand against those who would appropriate that phrase for ill, both those who would use it wrongly and those who would accuse it wrongly. And not 2 weeks before that, I sat in that same cathedral for the inurnment of Matthew Shepard, which was attended by thousands of people from the area and from outside the area to bring honor to this young man who, in simply living his life, raised our awareness of the dangers of hate crimes. So I'd say that's what I'm proud of.
Listeners, I want you to know that when those things happen, they're happening for you. Jack is speaking for you. Jack is there for you. And this is a way of making contributions to our nation that wouldn't be made if it wasn't for Interfaith Alliance and Jack Moline and the people with whom he worked. That's why I asked that question.
Now, thank you. You know, I stand on your shoulders when I do this, because that's what you did for all those years. And you really were my teacher. I don't want this to simply be a love fest between you and me, but I do want to highlight what you just said, that these stances that we take, though they seem to be for someone else, really affect the lives of everybody who's listening to this program and even those who aren't. Religious freedom is not just some sort of intellectual concept. It is something that impacts the day-to-day life of people who utilize our healthcare system, who are interested in the protections of the Constitution for their free speech and their free exercise. And we do this, you're exactly right, for the people who are listening to this program.
That makes me want to ask you, which is kind of a frustrating question, but what would you have liked to do in addition to what Interfaith Alliance was able to achieve if only we had more financial resources to work with?
So there are two things I can tell you specifically. The first is a project we've been desperately trying to get funded, but it is one of those things that has to be at a time when we have a little more discretionary funds. And that is the distribution of our FAQ about Muslims in America that we'd like to put in the hands of every member of Congress, every member of the Senate, every governor, and provide copies for every state legislature. That is the one project we hope to complete this summer that we were unable to do. But the other thing that I would really love to do, because I've got the will and I've got the time, and that is to come to the community of every person listening to this program, to speak to a group of people there, to listen to what their concerns are about religious freedom, and to further create this national network of support and activism on behalf of faith and freedom.
You know, the accomplishments that we've talked about have long-term consequences. And that's the same with what we're talking about right now, of what didn't get done that we would like to see done. There are long-term consequences of those kinds of limitations. Jack, just one illustration of if you had that money that you want, what could you do and what would be the consequences of the two things you talked about?
Well, certainly the consequence of the first would be that there would be no excuse for any legislator to listen to the likes of Frank Gaffney or Pamela Geller about what constitutes Islam, what constitutes American Muslims. I think that in and of itself would yank the underpinning out from underneath a lot of white nationalism, which is based on the same kinds of tropes for every minority group to which they object. I think I would take enormous pride if I heard even one legislator, it wouldn't matter to me whether it was on the federal level or a state level, saying, I simply can't vote for this measure that restricts the abilities of Muslims to live by Sharia or by the values of their faith, because Interfaith Alliance has instructed me on what American Islam really is, and it is the same as Christianity, as Judaism, as Hinduism, as Buddhism, in its devotion both to its internal principles and its commitment to constitutional values. That would bring me enormous pleasure.
Sure.
But I'll tell you what speaking to other people would bring me, and if you don't mind my sharing an email that we actually got from a listener who may be listening today. I don't yet have his permission to say his name on the radio, but I'm hoping we'll get that in time for you to say it in the future. This is an email that we got from someone who is an avid listener to State of Belief. It says, "Hi, I've been a donor for about a year, I guess, and a State of Belief junkie for several more than that. Recently, my wife and I revamped our wills, and I took a look at my options. What I've done is set Interfaith Alliance and my seminary as primary beneficiaries of a portion of one of my IRA accounts. At today's value, it would be about, I'm not going to say the number, but it's a five-figure number. Mm-hmm. But I set it as a percentage, so it stands to rise as time goes by, according to the market and additional contributions. I set this up just days before the tragic shooting in Pittsburgh, and I'm leaving in just a few minutes to attend Shabbat services with my Jewish friends, as they've invited the community to join them tonight. To me, remaining in close relationship with my interfaith partners locally and financially supporting the Interfaith Alliance are two ways to demonstrate positive love in opposition to such negative hate. I am grateful for your continued work. Keep the faith." So, Welton, you and I did that together, inspiring this this listener to support Interfaith Alliance long term, beyond the opportunity that he will have to make those contributions that he's undertaken as a donor. And if by speaking to our listeners, I could inspire a few more people like that, and by the way, not just for Interfaith Alliance, but for all good causes, I'd be grateful for that too.
Very grateful for you sharing that and for this good listener to share what he's done or his family has done for us. We're rapidly entering the year-end season when the donations of supporters make or break the annual budget for so many nonprofits. Interfaith Alliance is certainly in that position as well. November 27th, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, has come to be known as Giving Tuesday, falling as it does after several traditional shop-like mad days in the pre-Christmas season. And so I urge you, our listeners, the ones of you that are listening today, I urge you to take some time now to persuade listeners to pitch in and strengthen Interfaith Alliance and the work the organization does every day. Jack has just told you some of what is being done. I want to, before we get off, mention one other major, major thing that the Interfaith Alliance does that our nation badly needs. Jack, say a word about the lack of understanding of this great value of religious freedom and how important it is for us to have money to see to it that Americans once again understand that freedom so that we can protect it?
What we gain, Welton, by the willingness of people of faith to bring their values to the public square and to protect the rights and privileges of others to adhere to those values is to be a beacon to the nations and an inspiration to the next generation. There's so much cynicism in the land right now and so much validation of what I can only call the rhetoric of bigotry, that Interfaith Alliance and its allies are the ones who are countering what could become a very dark period for America and for the rest of the world. I heard a speaker the other day talk about what an extraordinary exception America is to world history. And it's up to us to preserve that very first freedom that guarantees that government will be independent of religion but responsive to it, and that religion will be independent of government but responsive to it. That's what we're all about.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, Protecting True Faith and Freedom. With Giving Tuesday coming up on November 27, I really hope you will give serious consideration to ensuring the future of Interfaith Alliance and State of Belief. Jack, it's always great to be with you. I appreciate so much what you're doing. I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving celebration and that you get a little rest and then come right back, because we always are pleased when we can welcome you to State of Belief and hear your message for our listeners.
Thanks, Walton. I'm going to eat some leftovers and get back to work.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you, thank you, thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Please keep us in mind as you plan your tax-deductible donations at the end of the year. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion going on there. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.